All right, welcome to a new talk on Grok the Talk. This is kind of talk number four concerning Mantis, and we're going to try and tie things up with that topic and move into some other areas, or to kind of return to where we were when we started these talks a couple of weeks ago. And John has given me the title for tonight to be The Portal of Wonder. I'll just put the date out here and we'll jump into things, John, okay? It is 2012, February the 24th, and we're right at a point where people should be able to see the sunset crescent of Nyodotmia or Swan Deva. I have yet to been able to catch a glimpse because of the clouds. How are things over there in Spain, John? Have you seen the sunset crescent?
Oh, yes, indeed. I saw it last night, and a beautiful scarlet blush in the Spanish sky, and it was a very small crescent, a young crescent, and it was seated perfectly on its bottom. Hmm. I've never seen a crescent so perfectly aligned horizontally to the horizon. Usually they, of course, have a slight tilt in them because the angle of the sun relative to the moon causes the crescent to be tilted. This crescent was not tilted. It was just sitting like a perfect chalice of ivory on its bottom, perfectly balanced against a scarlet-red sky with Venus above and Jupiter above that. This is a tremendous omen for the Swan Deva shift, and it's an omen for correction as a whole. Jupiter and Venus will be conjunct on March 15th. They'll be visible after sunset. And I'm going to be talking a lot in the Gaia Navigation Experiment about what is the significance of that omen for the healing of the sexual gender conflict, or what is called in Sophianic terms, the gender rift. The gender rift. The healing of this rift and the healing of our sexuality, which includes a completely new understanding of how we reproduce, is coming with this shift. So it's quite a momentous event looming on the horizon here.
Indeed, it was 1 year ago that the great earthquake here in Japan happened in the Swan Deva shift.
Yes, it'll almost be exactly 1 year to the day that the Jupiter-Venus conjunction occurs. Just a minute, I'm going to let the cat in. Now, Thomas, for the sake of continuity, I would like to say this.
Sure.
Those of you who are listening will know that not too long ago, Thomas and I started a new series, which is titled Love, War, and Gaia and Echo Sorcery. And the purpose of this series was to talk about Kali practices. We began with the Kali Yantra. I indicated that there is a mudra, which is a hand gesture you use to make the threefold vow to Kali. And all of that we considered at the beginning of this new series. The first talk was about love. And then there was that rather special talk about the carnal embrace of the Anthropos. Now, that is a Kalika practice, you could say, in a certain sense. It's also just a general Gayan Tantra practice. So we're in a continuity now. We're coming from the carnal embrace of the Anthropos, then followed by the terror of the Aeon Sophia, in which I introduced the Mantis. Mantis, excuse me. And then Mantis and Mitosis. And today is the concluding talk in this subgroup, the Portal of Wonder. So once we conclude today with the issues and questions that have been raised by this Mantis episode, we're going to return directly to the central theme of Kalika practices under the title of Love, War, and Gaian Echo Sorcery.
Right, and that'll actually be the second talk on that coming up.
Yes, we can consider the business about Mantis to be, in certain respects, a kind of a detour. It's a central factor in the Gaian Navigation Experiment, and it's certainly a central factor in the expanding and amplification of the Sophianic Vision story, which is now ongoing. I would signal you to the fact that now loaded on GaiaSpora.org you will find two talks on the initial conditions of the divine experiment, and there are more to come. So I am currently expanding the 9 episodes of the Gaian, of the Sophianic myth, beginning with episode 4, adding new material and adding new details, crucial details to that myth, things that we need to know in order to stay current with correction. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm doing through the telestic practices that allow me to investigate her recapitulation. So I hope that summary puts people in continuity with what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, will you be then incorporating that into like a rewriting of the original 9 chapters?
Well, eventually they will need to be rewritten, incorporating this new material. I suspect that by the fall, a great deal of the amplification that can be achieved now by following her recapitulation, I suspect that a great deal of it will be provided.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, I am engaged, and I invite some others of you who have taken a deep interest in the sacred narrative to do the same. I invite you to be engaged with me. We're going to get down in words and in writing the amplified version of this myth, FGS, Fallen Goddess Scenario 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also, there's a point, a very critical point coming up. I can see it coming probably later on this year when the moment comes to have a version of her story in the first person.
Hmm.
I.
Mm-hmm.
Her telling her story.
Mm.
So it would be the myth that we already know in 9 episodes, expanded and amplified with what now comes to be revealed by tracking her recapitulation through the lunar apogee. Okay, you all know the method now.
Mm-hmm.
And converting the story to a first-person syntax.
Hmm.
Yes. All right. And having it read by a woman, obviously.
Absolutely.
Okay? Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Right. She's finding her voice, you see. VV.
Indeed.
She's finding her voice. Right.
Yes. Things are getting very audible at the moment.
That's right. They are. So, Thomas, if I may, I'd like mm-hmm. to go back and pick up some of the things we've talked about, clarify some points,
sure.
answer some questions that have been sent my way.
Okay.
And we'll slowly cruise our way toward the portal of wonder.
Okay. Very good. Do you want to go with those terms to start things out? Do you want to
yeah.
clarify?
Yeah, I'd like to point out that I've been using the terms, 3 terms, which are much in use these days. Schizophrenic, psychopathic, and recently I've used the term psychotic. Now, I don't like to throw around these terms loosely. I'd like to have your understanding and confidence that when I use them carefully and not just in a haphazard or sloppy fashion. So I'd like mm-hmm. to say a little bit about each of these terms. Schizophrenic is a word that was coined by Eugene Bleuler at a clinic, psychiatric hospital in Zurich, Switzerland, around 1910, and I happen to know a lot about that story because I wrote a screenplay about C.G. Jung and a patient that he had in that clinic, Sabina Spielrein, an 18-year-old Russian girl who became his first mistress. And actually, Eugene Bleuler, who coined the term schizophrenia, it was used to be called dementia praecox, is a character in the film. So I know a lot about the origin. Quite a bit about the origin of schizophrenic, but in terms of our current use of it, let's understand that the word simply means a split mind. And in that mm-hmm. sense, we're all a bit schizophrenic. It's natural for the human being to have a split mind. There is a natural disposition to schizophrenia. It's really, really important to understand that in our species. Why is that so? It's very simple. It's because we all have 2 minds. We have the ordinary mind, and we have the subliminal mind, where the enlightened knowledge of the Dakinis is operating. In classical Buddhism, they called this underlying mind, the subliminal mind, they called it the Alaya Vijnana, or the store consciousness. So we have our ordinary mind, which is a product of our conditioning. It's the radio that plays in your head all the time. And it plays a number of familiar stations, because those are the stations that you are taught to tune into by your education and your culture and your family. Mm-hmm. Understand?
Yes.
But we also have a deeper mind, the mind of enlightenment within the ordinary mind. And that mind of enlightenment is also a place where there are flashes of genius and intuitions of brilliance and spiritual breakthroughs. And so we are all, in a certain sense, schizophrenic. We are all prone to operate in our ordinary mind, because we need to do that to function. But at the same time, we are susceptible to messages from the subliminal mind. And if we don't know how to read them correctly, then that schizophrenia can become a disordered state. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. You know, it's widely recognized now that most great geniuses have been either somewhat or rather extensively schizophrenic. Most great artists, and it's accepted now. So we shouldn't use the term in a derogatory way.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I want to say about split mind or schizophrenia is simply that it becomes a social problem, and it becomes a form of maladaptation and distortion of reality when there is unusual damage to the myelin sheath. And this is very well known. I'm not making this up. I pointed this out, and we brought this up in the previous talks. If the myelin sheath is the lecithin, how do you say it?
Lecithin.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the lecithin coating, an insulation on your nerves.
Mm-hmm.
And when that coating is either worn down or stripped off, which it can be by stress, or by a traumatic incident, or by nutrition, your wiring becomes raw. And just as if you had non-insulated wiring in a radio, to use an old-fashioned analogy, I'm not talking here about computerized circuits, I'm talking about just radio and TV wiring, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a better analogy. If you had uninsulated wires in radio or television, it would interfere with the performance, and the picture would be jumpy or scratchy, and the sound of one channel would bleed into the next, and so forth. And this is what mm-hmm. happens in more severe cases of schizophrenia that are due to damage to the myelin sheath. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
that
very
picture
clear.
To be really clear, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the psychopath, of course, is something that we all need to understand. And I urge you to go on YouTube and spend 2 or 3 days looking at a number of clips. I was just looking at one earlier. It's called Identifying Different Psychopaths, number 38.
Mm-hmm. And, I've seen that, yes.
Yeah, and there's a number of good, you can get a good education on YouTube learning how to identify psychopaths. The psychopath is basically characterized by 3 traits. And they are dangerous people in society and in our families. Their 3 traits are: they lack empathy for other people, although they can fake it and pretend that they have empathy. They are obsessed with control in one form or another, and they operate through lies and secrecy. So obviously these are the predators. Generally speaking, schizophrenics are not predators. Once in a while, a schizophrenic will freak out and murder someone randomly in the street. They can commit random acts of violence simply because they lose it because of the stress and disorder in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but basically, schizophrenia is not, I'm not saying it's benevolent, but it's not really malevolent. The malevolent psychological type is the psychopath. And then, and we're all responsible to understand what psychopaths are and recognize them. You cannot be a responsible person living in society today without knowing that. And if we're going to talk about the war for humanity and the war for sanity in these coming talks, then we really need to get on board the responsibility that that this war places on us. And mm-hmm. one of those responsibilities is to be able to recognize psychopathic behavior.
Right.
For
and
instance,
there's
in the bankers.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Sheridan adds on two other qualities, the extremely high levels of testosterone and compulsion to always create false histories of themselves, fake
yeah.
backgrounds and identities and things.
Yeah, well, they may have a lot of testosterone, but I'd like to see a woman who would, you know, lay down for them. They're so ugly and disgusting. You know, one thing you have to ask about psychopaths, when you look at people like Lloyd Blankfein, you know, you have to ask who would, you know, what woman would ever want to get within, you know, 10 feet of this creature, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
So they may be highly sexed, I don't know, but that they have a very hard time getting laid. That's why they need sex slave rings and they need to, you know, molest and rape people because
yeah.
they can't get a voluntary sex partner. You know what I mean?
Indeed, or to have the money to just buy what they want.
Yeah, just buy what they want and throw it away. Right. Next comes psychotic. Now, I'm gonna use this term more extensively as we go into the Kalika warfare perspective. And I'm going to use particularly the word the morbid psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
What is a morbid psychosis? It's a psychosis that leads to death. It is a psychosis. You see, schizophrenia is a maladaptation to social reality.
Mm-hmm.
Psychopathy is the manipulation of social reality for the selfish ends of an individual. But psychosis is the total loss of the sense of reality.
Hmm.
So psychotic is living, may appear to be living in the same world as us, in the same reality, but in fact they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, if there are really so-called Satanists in the world who are practicing these satanic rites and worshiping Satan, they would be in a state of morbid psychosis.
Hmm.
Because in fact, Satan doesn't exist. There is no Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And so insofar as they've dedicated their lives to Satan, they are living in a total state of insanity. And so what we're facing on the planet with these interspecies predators is various levels of predation, various levels of violence and deceit. But the hardcore group of predators of the human species at war with the rest of the human species are criminally insane. Criminally insane. And that is why there is no solution for these people except to eliminate them. So I hope that clarification of terms is helpful because we're going to use it in the future.
Very good. Yes, that was quick
yeah.
and right to the point. Wonderful. That's a good reference material, I think.
I just want to point out something that I heard on this clip that I was just
mm-hmm.
listening to. It's very interesting because I want to point out that, reiterating what I said, and we're going to get more into this in this talk, because some questions have come up regarding what I said about childbirth and birth trauma. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me reiterate what I said. The manner in which we are born, being forced through this narrow birth canal, is not the way that Sophia intended us to procreate in this experiment. So we have adapted to a situation which is not according to her design in the first place. And this adaptation is risky. It's not a completely successful adaptation. So every time that a child is born in this method, every time that a human being, a new individual member of the species has to be born in this way, by undergoing these severe convulsions, these contractions, which create immediately a sense of terror, and then by being forced head first through this inconceivably narrow channel, which is not designed
mm-hmm.
for that. This channel in a woman's body is not designed for that purpose. It's designed for other purposes. Okay. Due to that, various traumas can occur, but fundamentally, the damage is to the medulla oblongata. Now, the medulla oblongata is called the brain stem. It's right at the back of your neck. You can go and run your finger along it. You go put your finger in that narrow place at the back, at the bottom of your skull. There's kind of a narrow place, and run it down. That's where the medulla oblongata is, and this is obviously a very delicate area. You can kill someone very easily by standing behind them and twisting their neck and breaking it at that place.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely delicate place that undergoes enormous stress when you're born. Because even if you're not pulled out by your head, when your head comes out, your body is still inside. And so during that moment, when the head is outside of the birth orifice and the shoulders are still inside, there's an enormous stress placed on this area.
Right.
Reach back there and touch it. It's a very delicate area. You can kill somebody. You can paralyze someone for life by whacking them with your fist in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that?
Indeed.
If you ever need to kill somebody, that's a place to go for.
That's one of them, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of them. So what I'm saying is the brainstem connects the brain and its neural circuitry with the spinal cord and its complex set of spinal nerves that constitute the autonomic nervous system. And so there's the potentiality when that connection of the brainstem is stretched and then contracted and stretched and contracted in the process of birth, that it screws up the wiring of the brainstem. And when the wiring of the brainstem, we all risk that when we're born, but in some cases, the damage happens. And those people who have that damage are excessively prone to become psychopathic and psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to point this out, that the brainstem regulates the functions of the autonomic nervous system of the body, including, very critically, these functions, breathing and cardiac functions. And one of the things that was pointed out in this clip about psychopaths was that it's showing Al Gore, it's showing Lloyd Blankfein, and it's saying that these psychopaths depend on lying. They lie. I can't find the exact quote right here, and I don't want to get distracted. But he says specifically, when a psychopath lies, like Lloyd Blankfein sitting in front of Congress lying, or the President of the United States, who's probably a Manchurian candidate as well as a psychopath, lie to the public, they don't feel what you and I feel when we lie. You see, if you're a normal human being and you lie, you feel it affects your breathing and your heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they use lie detectors.
Use lie detectors,
right.
Sure.
But even without a lie detector, a perceptive person can tell if another person is lying because their heartbeat and their cardiac function changes. But with a psychopath, it doesn't. It doesn't change. So they don't have the impediment of the body telling them that they are lying so that they can catch themselves in the act of lying. And that explains why, in many cases, they don't even know that they're lying.
Sure.
Because
especially if they're getting into the psychotic area of things.
That's right. Especially if their lying is connected with a high level of fabulation and fabrication and hoaxing, which it usually is. So you see, that's due to the fact that the brainstem or medulla oblongata has been damaged, and it does not provide the proper signaling to the respiratory system and the cardiac system so that they would react to the lie. So there is this physiological basis for psychopathic behavior. Okay. I'd like to go on.
Was that the question then from...
No, I'm going to read the question in just a second.
Okay, I see.
I just want to point out that I'm not the first person by any means to suggest that there is some kind of birth trauma affecting humanity that is fundamental to our behavior and fundamentally distorts our behavior in some way or another. In fact, one of the first people to write about that was Otto Rank, O-T-T-O-R-A-N-K. He was a disciple of Freud. He also wrote a book on the hero, interestingly, one of the first books on the hero, and he connected the hero with the idea of birth trauma. So you can go read about Otto Rank. He introduced the idea of birth trauma. And currently, Lloyd DeMause, D-E capital M-A-U-S-E, who is the founder of a system called Psychohistory, also talks about birth trauma somewhat in that similar respect, although he tends to emphasize in a curious way to talk about the placenta and the entrapment of the embryo in the placenta as being a primary act of trauma and terror. And curiously, he connects the placenta with the mythological image of the Medusa. And what does that remind you of, the Medusa?
Well, of Cetus.
Of Cetus and Perseus.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. We know that the intervention pact that Sophia made with our species is represented in a sort of veiled way in the myth of Perseus. And Perseus, of course, slays the Medusa and uses the head of the Medusa to paralyze Cetus. So this is coming up really, really soon in the Gaia navigation experiment. Yeah.
And that's connected into the shift of Nyadoctomia as well.
It Andromeda, is, because we are now under the constellation of Pisces, right? Swan Deva has the constellation of Pisces. Finally, I just might add that Stan Grof, who was one of the greatest psychotherapists and entheogenic researchers of the 20th century, probably the greatest, talks extensively about this birth trauma, extensively. And he makes his... bases his whole therapeutic practice on these four conditions that he recreates in the patient, which are called perinatal. That is to say, peri meaning imitating or repeating the natal experience. So he takes people through these four stages of being born in order for them to relive the trauma, in order for them to integrate it and grow out of that trauma.
Hmm.
So my introduction of the idea that we're not meant to reproduce in the way that we do, which is a purely a Gnostic proposition, may sound far out, but actually it belongs to the very heart and core of some of the most profound and insightful healing psychotherapy of the 20th century, say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a fluke. I know it sounds that way because when I say, as the Gnostics did, I'm against procreation, we're not intended to procreate in that way. I mean, it just sounds, you know, it strikes people as very, very odd and ridiculous and absurd to even say such a thing.
Right. It sounds like it goes against nature.
Yeah. It doesn't go against nature. It just goes against a maladaptation in nature that our species had to make due to Sophia's own fault. Because it's her fault that we are born in this way rather than through meiosis as she intended us to be when she dreamed our experiment. So we're not going to blame anybody but her if you want to blame anybody. Now, speaking of blame, let me answer this email that came from Stephanie, who is one of the crew members, a faithful crew member, and one who has recorded a version of the a narrative, a spoken narrative of the Sophianic myth. She says in her mail that she has a question about this statement about mitosis, in which she says, I can see how some women who hear your words in this talk will jump to a defensive stance and be turned off. There is an argument to be made, as if women didn't have enough blame on their shoulders already from organized religion. Now JLL is suggesting that something as natural as childbirth, in the form we know it today, is the cause of psychosis, and that our children are being born with trauma that we are helpless to avoid. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
End quote. This is a consideration. She asked me to address this consideration. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it never occurred to me that this would be taken in that way.
Mm-hmm.
That women would be blamed because the design of childbirth is traumatic and poses the risk of producing damaged people who become psychotic.
I wouldn't have heard it that way in my wildest dreams, but I guess some
it's
people
possible.
May have.
It's possible. So I'm not going to dismiss that thought, but I just want to say our children are being born with trauma. No, not our children are being born. We are being born. We. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Every one of us, yeah.
Yeah. Every one of us is born with a risk of a damaged condition of the most delicate part of the human body, the brainstem. I mean, do you think Sophia herself would design a reproductive process for her pet species that she cherishes so highly because of the gifts she's endowed in us and cause us to be born in such a way that it actually risks that the very precious instrument that she's given us? It doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
You see? It just doesn't make any sense. There is something wrong with the way that we are born. And so I would hope to make it very clear to all of you that I'm not blaming women for this problem, you know, not in the least. In order to understand this problem, we need to go way, way back into our prehistory of our species and understand when the division of the sexes took place, how we were originally designed to reproduce, and how we came to reproduce in the way that we do now. Now, Sophia herself, in her recapitulation, is coming to the moment when she will remember how she sheared the Anthropos template. The shearing of the Anthropos template, in Gnostic terms, is what is called, in classical mythology, the separation of the sexes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a theme you find in many myths. You find it discussed in the Symposium of Plato. You find it mentioned and described in various ways, from fanciful to plausible, in indigenous mythologies. It's an inescapable theme of world mythology, the separation of the sexes. The separation of the sexes was a real event that happened at a certain point in Sophia's own story, in her own story. And when she recalls that in real time, relatively soon, if I can observe her recapitulation as I did in January, I ought to be able to give a clear description of that event. And then from that event, we can come forward and understand our situation today. This is a massive piece of her biography, but also a massive piece of our own.
Mm-hmm.
And it is absolutely essential that we understand this to proceed properly in correction. Okay?
Very good.
So that gives us something to work on. So I'm just going to very quickly go to these 4 points of Stephanie, and then we'll move on.
Okay.
She asks, why do we currently reproduce through mitosis and not meiosis? How and when did the change, and how this change, and why? And this point seems completely fundamental in her correction and the correction of the Anthropos. Well, that is totally true. And as I just said, we are proceeding very rapidly to the point of sorting that matter out. So I've already answered that question. 2, did she design other mammal species to use meiosis as well, but for some reason they are using mitosis? No. She designed reproduction on this planet to be mainly and largely through meiosis, which is what you can see at the molecular levels.
Mm-hmm.
And she designed other animal species, most of them, to mate and to reproduce through mitosis. And that's how she designed it, for particular reasons of her own. Okay? Third, why can the psychopaths hear the cries of the mantis, but the rest of us can't? What is the connection of the psychopaths to the mantis? The sounds of the mantis, the sounds that are coming from the interior of the earth now, these ultrasonic or ELF waves, are not necessarily heard by psychopaths. They don't necessarily hear them audibly, but they are like waves. They are waves that irritate and excite the medulla oblongata. They are waves that particularly reach that frequencies that are in that part of our body. Every single part of the human body is in a state of vibration. The heart is vibrating. It's a vibrating magnet. The bloodstream, the entire bloodstream is vibrating with the iron magnetism. It's not just flowing through the veins. At the same time, it's vibrating. Every cell is vibrating. The ribosomes of our cells are vibrating madly and producing ATP. And so these vibrations, this field of vibrations, which is, we call the human body, is susceptible to receive and channel other vibrations from the environment. And what I'm saying is that the psychopaths, with the damaged wiring of their brainstem, are particularly susceptible to the frequencies that are coming from the center of the earth. And they are getting in an enormous state of agitation and excitation right now. Huge. They're worked up to an absolute frenzy. That's why you see on the mainstream news in the United States all of this hype, which is totally false, about the threat of Iran and we must go to war and, you know, let's have World War III and let's get them before they get us. There's a massive excitation of the psychopaths right now by these screeching sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, she asks, is the current situation with the mantis the ultimate threat to the anthropos you've spoken of before? No, it isn't, but I'm getting to the ultimate threat very, very soon, folks. I'm not just teasing you on that one. I really do intend to deliver, but I need to put it in the context of her story, and I need to do my practice rigorously so that I communicate it in the clearest way possible. That's why I'm holding it back just a little bit, but I know exactly what it is in a word.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that answers the four questions there. So do you want to?
I think so. Yeah.
Do you want to get more into kind of rounding up things, at least for now, on mantis?
Well, yeah. The way that we might do that, you and I talked about this before the reading, for the recording, is I might describe how I met mantis.
Right. Right.
Since this would perhaps give some kind of validity to the surreal event.
Fantastic. Okay? Yeah, I really want to hear about this. And then when we come to the end of that, I do have a couple questions I want to throw at you that are unclear or that I would like to explore a bit.
Okay.
But please.
Well, good. I think our timing is good because we're at 38 minutes.
Yeah.
I can probably deliver this little anecdote.
So this is about 40 years ago.
Yeah, it was. I looked it up and it was when I was in L.A., I think it was around, I was 30 in 75. I think it was about 1977, 78 in L.A. So I was 32, 33 years old. Now I was living in L.A. In the Hollywood Hills above Hollywood Boulevard. And I was deeply immersed in anthroposophy at the time. And during that period of my life, from about 28 until 35, I had a massive, massive sequence of lucid dreams. So I was lucid dreaming constantly, did many, many things. About half of those lucid dream experiences involved fighting off these winged bat creatures, you know, what Castaneda called the mud shadows. Just night after night after night. I mean, it was exhausting. I used to sleep for two or three days at a time. I was so tired from these psychic battles. I would have friends. I had this friend. She was in the anthroposophical movement. she used to like come to my house and knock on the door to find out if I died or anything, you know, because I would sometimes sleep for literally 2.5 days from the exhaustion of having had these experiences. So anyway, around the age of 30, a couple of years before this one lucid dream happened, I started to have a series of dreams in which these two characters appeared. And it was like every night there would be these scenarios going on, these adventures, and there would be various people in different scenes. It wasn't what is called a recurring dream. The dreams were different each time. But after a while, I noticed that two characters always seemed to be showing up. And, you know, it's as if you went to some place and you hung out there, and after a while you noticed that there were two other people who were always there, you know? The thing about these two characters, as I call them, is that they didn't always appear the same. Sometimes they appeared as twin brothers. Sometimes they appeared as a young boy and an old boy. Occasionally they appeared as girls. But even when they appeared as girls, I remember there was one dream when they appeared as girls, and like I was talking to them, and I said, hey, you guys, come on, you know, I know it's you, you know, what are you looking like girls for now?
What are you trying to put on over me?
Yeah, what are you trying to pull over me, you know? And they were always around and always around, and like I couldn't figure out what they were doing. It was like they were shadowing me. They were surveilling me. And so this went on literally for 2 years. And I got so used to them that I used to laugh when they showed up. You know, in some dream scenario, I would be plugging my way through some dream scenario, and suddenly there they would be. I'd look over across the street, and there they would be, and I'd kind of be, hey, there you are, you know. But I had no idea what they were doing and who they were or why they kept showing up. The content of my dream life at that time was tremendously varied. I mean, I've been to all the planets in the solar system in these lucid dreams, you know? I mean, I was really traveling around. And they were the one recurrent element, but I couldn't figure out why. Okay, so it gets to be, I guess, around spring of 1978, something like that. And I'm sleeping in my little apartment in L.A. under the house next to the garage on Sycamore Avenue near the Yamashiro, overlooking the entire the Hollywood area below me. And I have this dream. And the first thing I remember in the dream is that I'm in this narrow defile. I'm underground in the earth, and I'm in this narrow, like canyon or passageway, which is kind of lit from the rocks, and the rocks of it are some kind of crystal, and the ground beneath me is highly polished, and it appears as if my feet don't really touch the ground, which is very curious. I'm kind of like slipping along as if I was walking on ice, and on either side of me is this crystal, which is kind of dimly lit, so I can sort of see there's no lighting in the tunnel, and it's not a man-made tunnel, a natural formation. And I can sort of see my way in it, and so I'm walking down this tunnel. This is where I wake up. But the moment that I wake in this dream, I realize that I am sleeping in my bed, in my apartment at the same time. So it is a lucid / bilocation dream. I was bilocating. So I proceed to walk down this narrow passageway, and before too long, not very far, it opens up, and I can see more light, and I can see that there is a cavern. And I come to the entrance of this cavern, and it's like a grotto, completely enclosed by this lemonish yellow crystal with kind of green, some kind of green rays in it here and there, but very pale. And it's huge. I mean, it's a huge, huge cavern. And as soon as I enter the cavern, my eyes immediately go to this creature, which is sitting on a kind of seat, not really a chair, but a platform carved out of the quartz. Seated on this platform is a huge, huge mantis. Must have been at least 40 feet tall if it were stretched out. But it's sitting there, perched in the manner that mantises are, with its praying paws in front of it. A new massive head, like I say, a head like a squashed Volkswagen Beetle, big flat head. And it's looking off. I'm off to its left. I come in from its left, and it's looking down, and it's looking off to its right, and it's looking down. Well, I mean, what do you do in a situation like this, you know? So I thought, first of all, I was floored by how beautiful it was. I could see that it was made of almost like a pure amber substance, of such a beautiful yellow, yellowish green, you know, what the color of these mantises are. And it looked just like a real mantis, sort of transparent. You could look, it was opaque, you could look into it, but it was it was massive, and it was alive. I could tell it was alive. Because it's
so it had the general appearance of a praying mantis that we know,
totally.
But you could tell that it was not organic.
Well, I didn't know anything at this time. When you're in a lucid dream like this and you're in the Nahual, you're in a totally supernatural environment, which is just as real as the natural environment. But you can't use your mind. One of the things is you can't try to figure out what it is. Later, if you're lucky, you might be able to use your reasoning to put it together. Which is what I, in fact, did, and I'll share that with you. But at the moment, you don't do that. The point at the moment is to be in a state of wonder. This kind of brings us to the title of this talk. To stay in a state of wonder. That means to stay in the state of surprise and wonder, but be sober. Hold your sobriety, and most of all, hold your consciousness. Do not, as Terence McKenna says regarding the DMT experience, do not be overcome with amazement, okay? Be amazed, because if you're not amazed, you're not there. But do not be overcome by amazement. So I'm standing there, I'm holding the amazement. I'm looking at this creature, it's so beautiful. I notice that it's alive, it's moving, because its praying hands are moving quite slightly. And I look up at its face, and as I say, it's looking down and to its right. And I was impressed by its expression. You know, mantises are very expressive. You know, they look you right in the eyes. You know, I mean, you can they really have a way of it's something about the gaze of a mantis that's remarkable.
Indeed, they'll give you a little quizzical look,
yeah,
like they're looking into
they
you.
They do. And I noticed that it was looking down. It was like it was brooding. And I thought, boy, this mantis is like sullen. This mantis is like pissed off about something. You know, it was sullen. It had this sullen look, and it was looking down at another part of the grotto and just sort of looking down at the ground. It was pouting. Oh, wow, that's interesting. So now I did the craziest thing, and I have done some really outrageous things in my life in the Nahual. Goddess knows where they come from or what inspires me to do these things.
The impulse to do it.
I think it's just pure recklessness, you know.
So
I'm standing there, and suddenly I was overcome with this emotion. And like I feel really moved to address this 40-foot insect, you know. Now, I would advise those who are listening, you know, if you ever find yourself in the presence of a 40-foot insect, you might think twice before bringing yourself to its attention.
Sure.
You know?
Be inobtrusive, yeah.
You might be wiser to be a little inobtrusive, but I was really not. And I sort of cleared my throat, you know? It was like I was excuse me, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, really silly. And I said, and this is exactly what I said, I swear to you. This is a direct quote. I said, well, as long as I'm here, I guess I could offer you something. So how about a piece of my humanity, since you obviously don't have any?
Hmm. What did you mean by that when you said that?
I have absolutely no idea. It just like came out of me like that.
It just popped out.
Yeah. I said, how about I give you a piece of my humanity, since you obviously have none?
Mm-hmm.
It was like something a kid would say, you know, at some political meeting or something. I mean, just, you know how kids blurt things out and you don't know where mm-hmm. it comes from?
Mm-hmm.
It was like that. Well, at that moment that I said that, no sooner did I get those words off my lips, then it flicked its eyes in my direction. At that instant, I fainted.
And I fainted in a lucid dream.
I fainted wow. in a lucid dream, and I started to drop. Now, what I realized later on, I didn't know this at the moment. See, during this dream, by the way, I had no fear whatsoever.
Not yeah, I was going to ask you that. Second. Did you feel fear?
I did not have fear for a second. I was in a state of total wonder. And wonder eats fear.
Wonder eats fear. That's I like that.
Mm-hmm. I had no fear. I didn't feel that my life was in danger. My life was in extreme danger during this whole experience. But I only came to understand that later on. Very quickly, I understood that. As soon as this manus turned its gaze to me, that is to say, lifted its gaze off its sullen concentration on the floor and shifted it in my direction. I fainted. I started to hit the floor. Just imagine how long it would take me to hit the floor. Less than a second. The next thing I knew, there were two people holding me up. One on each side of me.
And they had see that. Okay.
They had caught me. With their hands, they had caught my elbows, and my elbows were pressed to my side, and their hands were under my elbows, and they were holding me up, and my feet, and it's like my toes were like dragging along the surface of the ground, except my toes were not touching the surface of the ground, just barely kind of sliding,
mm-hmm.
okay? And they were dragging me out of this grotto. Back up along the narrow passageway where I had come in. And I must have only swooned for a few seconds before they snatched me and started to pull me out of there. Rushing to pull me out of there on either side of me. And we're going through this narrow tunnel and we start to ascend. And they're talking with each other and they're kind of laughing. And making these comments. And at that moment, my mind tumbled. And this happens in a lucid dream. And it can happen in various ways. The tumble of the mind means that you acquire a certain cognitive abilities that you normally possess, but that are taken away from you when you are in direct confrontation with certain forces and presences in the Nahual. When you cannot be in the presence of certain things in the Nahual with your normal cognitive faculties. They are momentarily taken away from you. So that you can have
because heightened perception. Because they would get in the way, in a sense.
They would impede, and they would okay. confuse you, and they would get between you and your experience. So I had been divested of that, and I knew how to allow that to happen because it's happened to me many times. And I do it now voluntarily all the time when I do these telestic practices. But then you tumble. The mind tumbles back. It's like the analogy is like to the tumblers in the combination of a lock. of a safe. You know how when someone is turning the lock of a safe and they turn it to three different numbers in sequence, and then the tumblers fall into place and the safe locks and unlocks. Okay? Well, your mind has tumblers. And my mind had been locked so that I could have the supernatural experience. And now it tumbled back to its open position. And I got a flood of information. And I realized that, first of all, this grotto was an open space at the center of the earth inside an enormous geode of citrine or lemon quartz. That it is a completely anaerobic and antiseptic environment. There was no air in that grotto. That's when I realized that the mantis could not be like an ordinary mantis, that it was an inorganic, massive inorganic replica, but it's still alive. It was an inorganic being, but it's still alive. Castaneda talks about these all the time. Then I realized that the sterility of the mantis' grotto was lethal. It was so lethal to anything that lived that if you touched it with your skin, you would instantly die.
Hence the kind of floating aspect of your movement.
Right. I was allowed to be able to float in, but if I had hit the ground, I would have died instantly. And they would have found me dead in my room on Sycamore. This happens, you know.
Sure.
So I realized, you know, in this moment that I was being dragged out of there, all of this came into my mind in a flash, in a rush of understanding. I realized that I had been in a completely sterile environment in which nothing lives, nothing can live in that grotto. Not one amoeba, not the slightest trace of life. It's a sterile, absolutely sterile place inside the center of the earth. The last place where the organic light formed a precipitate of inorganic matter, which is an inconceivable physical event, but it happened. It's a surreal event, but it happened. And I realized that had I, when the mantis put its gaze to me, I could not live in the gaze of that mantis. No one can. So when the mantis shifted its gaze to me, I was a goner. I was a dead goner at that moment. If I had hit the ground, I would have been dead at the age of 32. But curiously, there were these two characters hanging around.
Right.
And they'd been hanging around for 2 years already. They had been watching me so closely that it must have been an assignment for them to watch what I was doing in the event that I would find myself to this place.
Right.
In the event that I would do the foolish and reckless kind of thing that I'm known to do, so that I wouldn't kill myself down there by bringing my the attention of mantis to my presence, you know?
Right, right.
So they saved my life, these two characters.
Now, the obvious question there would be, have you seen them since that time?
That was it.
I see. So they fulfilled their role and
That's absolutely right. After that, they ceased to appear in my dreams. I've never seen them since. And they took me. A very interesting thing happened. They were laughing. They were obviously very happy that they succeeded in their assignment. And they pull me up, and we go up and up, and finally see an open crack, and we're coming out somewhere on the earth. We're coming out of this crack, of this crevice. They drag me out of this crevice, and it's a beautiful green field. Beautiful rolling green field. And off in the distance, I can see these cliffs. And I can, far, far off, I can see the sea. And they take me, they haul me up and drag me onto the ground. And then they, like, sling me down into this kind of ditch. It's this place where the ground had been cut open. And they kind of, you know, like rubbing their hands together, you know. And they just
all
the
day's
work, right? And they split. And I'm laying there, like, you know, feeling still kind of exhausted and shaken by this experience. And I'm thinking, I'm going, oh, wow, what is that smell? This smells so good. It smells so sweet, so lovely and sweet, and it's coming from the ground. And I realized years later, I didn't know it at the time, but years later, when I went to the Isle of Lewis in the Scotland, in the Outer Hebrides, I went up to the Isle of Lewis to check out the Callanish, which is a very famous megalithic circle out there. And as soon as I was driving around the Isle of Lewis and I smelled something very strong, and I thought, oh, wow, that's the same smell that I smelled when they pulled me up out of that pit. It's peat. It's the smell of peat. Peat moss.
Right.
It smells so beautiful when it's cut and when it's burning, even more so. So what
Indeed.
They did was they pulled me out and dumped me in a ditch in Ireland. And that's where I woke up.
Wow. That is just absolutely mind-blowingly fascinating. I don't know what to say more about that. That's just amazing. That's one of the most intriguing stories I've ever heard.
Well, needless to say, Thomas, I was pretty intrigued myself.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know what to make. At the time, I was deeply steeped in Steiner material, anthroposophy,
uh-huh.
you know. So I figured
right.
it was like Ahriman, you know. Steiner
uh-huh.
talks about this figure called Ahriman. He talks about Lucifer and Ahriman as being the two great
mm-hmm.
adversaries of humanity, and then they're supernatural beings who try to deviate us. And then the Christ stands between them as the representative of humanity who balances the forces of Lucifer and Ahriman, you know. That's a Steinerian
uh-huh.
scenario. So I was deeply involved in Steinerian studies at the time, and I thought, oh, God, I must have been Ahriman, you know. I look like Ahriman. I guess I'll call it Ahriman. But I was never really satisfied with that conclusion because it didn't fit into any story. I mean, what should Ahriman be doing stuck in a quartz cave in the center of the earth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until many, many years later, decades later, that I got the Sophianic vision myth. And then, or now, actually, in the Gaian navigation experiment, I am able to expand and amplify the known episodes. And so it is simply my inference. No one has to follow me here. I could be wrong, folks. But it is simply my inference that this mantis was associated with this episode in the early period of Sophia's mm-hmm. transformation into the material elements mm-hmm. of the earth.
Well, yeah, before we started recording, we were debating whether we should go into this or not, just, you know, because it might not be relevant in one sense. But
yeah,
I'm very thrilled that we did. I think that's an important thing to get that person's story, you know, told that way.
Well, it's an anecdote from my mystical life, but, you know, I wouldn't have told you that if I didn't think it may be relevant in some way to...
Mm-hmm.
To our experiment now, and I have, you know, my investigations are not infallible, but they do have a lot of practice behind them. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. We're all most to the end of the recording possibilities, but I do want to run one possibility or one question by you here.
Sure.
Last time you were talking about the mantra of, you know, mantis will out.
Right.
And we were talking about possible locations, two locations, one in South Africa and perhaps in Canada.
Right.
And a thought occurred to me. I was wondering about the timing of things. It would seem to make sense to me that she would choose either the new moon or the full moon using the momentum, you could say, or the pull of the barycenter, because they'd be either their maximum or their minimum at those two points.
Right.
And I was wondering if you had entertained that thought so far.
I considered it, but I think it's more likely that she's going to use Jupiter. I've been investigating very closely how she's using Jupiter. And this is a deeply mysterious subject, but one that we do well to understand in the Gaia navigation experiment. You see, she can use any of the other planets in the solar system in her process of correction in any way that she wants. She's like a tantrika. A tantrika turns anything around. For a tantrika, if there's something working against you, you can turn it around and use it to work for you. You see, she's a tantrika, Vivi. That's why we picture her as a tantric deity in this identical node, in her sixth identical node. We picture her that way to help us understand how she operates. And I do believe that she's using Jupiter. And I've been looking very close and hard at why, you know, what is going on with Jupiter. And if my investigations go well, I can say more about that very, very soon.
Okay. All right. So when that comes up at the right time, then please remind me.
It would have to be Jupiter, because Jupiter is the most massive planet in the solar system. And it has the most massive... There are particular radio signals coming from Jupiter that are very interesting, that don't come from any other planet. It also has the most massive gravitational thrust and other factors that she can use. In some way, this is my hunch, in some way she's using Jupiter. And it may be connected with how she's going to spring the spring Mantis. May well be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay. I'm getting some intimations on that then.
Excellent.
I do have a couple other things that I want to run by you, but I think
we should maybe shelve them. Yeah. Okay.
Let's just shelve those until the appropriate time in future talks, and we can go into them at that time.
Very, very good.
Good. So, John, the next talk then will be a continuation of this, the Portal of Wonder, and we'll get back into kind of where we were going to be going about a month ago or so.
That's an excellent approach.
Okay.
Good.
Very good. I'll contact you in a couple days here about when we can set up another recording.
Thank you so much.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, John, and have a good day there.